fellas want to read me my rights.
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard, boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're gonna get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 179. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your Harvard Law man, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Harvard Law?
Hey, Thomas. How are you?
Doing great. I'm excited for today's episode. It's breaking news, so we can't really talk too much about it. But I don't know if you saw, Donald Trump is going to possibly pardon Rod Blagojevich. He's going to pardon Martha Stewart. These are things that as we record this ahead of time, so you will have gotten the results. I can assume he's also going to pardon, O.J. Simpson, anyone.
Are you being serious on Blagojevich and Stewart?
It is a headline as we are recording right now that he is possibly pardoning Martha Stewart and Rod Blagojevich. And I really think that it's just an attempt to normalize pardoning.
Yeah. I think that's exactly
everybody.
Right.
I'll pardon this guy, this person, this woman, this person, and Michael Cohen and Donald Trump, and I just pardon a bunch of people, no specific rhyme or reason to it. I pardon Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, and also it's just like he's if he builds up a big enough list of pardons, then he can just sneak him and his family members into it.
I think that's exactly right, because I am literally stunned that you would pardon Blagojevich. And again, this is one of these where I feel good about it, right? Like, because he was ostensibly our guy, right? The Democratic governor of Illinois, and as far as I know, every Democrat was like, yeah, good riddance to that guy, get him out of there. And when you say I've got this thing, it's an effing gold mine, and I'm not just going to give it away for nothing. Wow. Referring to Barack Obama's vacated Senate seat, right? And selling it to the highest bidder.
I really think he's trying to, he thinks that we think like him. So he thinks that if he pardons some Democrats, then we're like, oh, okay, well, it's fine that you pardon Arpaio. As long as you pardon our team too. It's like, no, we care about the law, it doesn't matter that Rod Blagojevich was a Democrat. He was immensely corrupt. And, that's not that.
Is Martha Stewart a Democrat? Because I love Martha Stewart. Oh, man.
I know she's best friends with Snoop Dogg. So I've seen that video. And I'm pretty sure she's a Democrat, right? Who knows? But anyway, I think that's the point. I think that's what he's trying to do. So we'll keep an eye on that. And hopefully by the time you're hearing this, Republicans in Congress were so outraged by this that they're finally acting.
that's what puts us over Yodel Mountain. Now we were good up until you gave that pardon
even
to Martha
be surprised.
Stewart.
I'm telling you, something he does, if he goes too far for congressional Republicans, then the floodgates will open, I really think. Because
I agree with that.
All the stuff they're ignoring and pretending like doesn't exist, once they want him out, they'll use all of it. And they'll be like, well, what about this and this and this and this? All the things we've been saying all along. But we'll see. I don't know if he ever will go that far. Someone will always drag him back. But anyway, we've got an episode to get to. We're going to talk about the abortion gag orders that Trump enacted. Obviously depressing news, but we're going to break it down. And then also we've got some follow-ups on plea bargaining, more listener comments, and an Iowa case. So that's our schedule for today. How about it?
Yeah.
Down. Along. down,
the law, breaking
down,
the law, breaking
down,
the law.
All right, well, we'll talk about this global gag order. Now, is this the one that just turns on and off depending on if it's a Republican or Democrat in office, or is this, or has Trump gone further?
Yeah, it's further than that, right? So the international gag order is the one that turns on and off based on whether you elect a Democrat or Republican, and it involves U.S. funds sent overseas. It is called the Mexico City policy. It's not worth getting into because, again, that's a it's a straightforward you elected a Republican. The most recent
I mean,
gag
it's still stupid and I
disagree. Yeah, right. But you know that, right? Yeah. Like that's again, all of the Jill Stein voters and, you know, Democrats who were like, I'm sure Trump really likes gay people secretly in his heart, you know, but we've made that point already.
Right.
What is new is the proposed gag rule that applies domestically. And here's what it covers and how it applies and what's going to happen and what we can and mostly can't do about it. So there is a program called Title 10. It is 42 USC Section 300. And under that program, the Secretary of Health and Human Services is authorized, I'm quoting from the statute directly, to make grants and to enter into contracts with public or nonprofit private entities to assist in the establishment and operation of voluntary family planning projects, which shall offer a broad range of acceptable and effective family planning methods and services, including natural family planning methods, infertility services, and services for adolescents. Okay. This statute is not controversial. Okay. The basic services that it provides are preventative care to women, which include wellness exams, cervical, breast cancer screenings, birth control, contraception education, and testing for sexually transmitted diseases and HIV. Now I'm going to read, this is from Planned Parenthood. In 2016 alone, health centers, including predominantly Planned Parenthood, used Title X funding to provide 700,000 pap smear tests for cervical cancer, more than 4 million STD tests, including HIV tests, and 1 million women with breast exams for breast cancers. Okay, so really, really important source of funding for the women's health work that Planned Parenthood does. And up against this is the fact that, you know, this is, like I said, not a controversial law. And so the law has protections within it for religious beliefs, including discriminating for and against abortion. And in particular, there's a provision, Section 300A-6, which says none of the funds appropriated under this subchapter shall be used in programs where abortion is a method of family planning. Right. So Title X, Title 10 does not subsidize abortion. But as you're reading that 300A-6, you might notice that it has some expansive language. Health and Human Services is an executive agency. So the question is, how do you implement that provision, Section 300A-6? And the answer is the executive agency, the Department of Health and Human Services, promulgates regulations. The existing regulations that are in place provide and protect medical advice to women that is consistent with the Constitution. The new proposed rulemaking from Trump's HHS would repeal those protections. And in particular, it would do three things. So the first is the gag part of this gag order. And this is not liberal freakout. This is not an area where people are overreporting it. I'm going to read directly from the notice of proposed rulemaking. The proposed rule would prohibit recipients from using Title X funds to perform, promote, refer for, or support abortion as a method of family planning. A doctor would be permitted to provide non-directive counseling on abortion. Such non-directive counseling would not be considered encouragement, promotion, or advocacy of abortion as a method of family planning, as prohibited under this proposed rule. Moreover, as permitted by earlier regulations, a doctor would be permitted to provide a list of licensed, qualified, comprehensive healthcare service providers, some but not all of which provide abortion in addition to comprehensive prenatal care. And then this is the crucial part. Providing such a list would be permitted only if a woman who is currently pregnant clearly states that she has already decided to have an abortion. So let's break all of that down. This says you may not, if you receive Title X funds in any way, you may not perform, promote, refer for, or support abortion as a method of family planning. You may not. So a woman comes into a clinic, you can provide a test for her, regardless of whether you're using the funds or not, if you also say, and by the way, one of the family planning options is abortion, the government can rescind your Title X grants. You are permitted to provide what they call non-directive counseling on abortion, and I'm going to talk about that in part two of this, but I suspect you know where that's going. There is a loophole, and HHS has publicly come out and said, look, like we've just said, you can't instruct a woman, you know, that's what non-directive versus directive. They say, look, we just say you can't instruct a woman, you know, to go get an abortion, but you can still give her information. You can only give her that information, again, that last sentence that I read, if she is already pregnant and she has already said, yes, yes, I want an abortion now, give me a list of providers that includes abortion providers. If she does not affirmatively make that statement, then you may not give her the information. And obviously, right, this is why it's fair to call it a gag rule. If you've already decided to have an abortion, you're precisely the kind of person who doesn't need information about abortion. You've already made up your mind, right? The question is, can you provide medically accurate information? This gag order would say, no, you cannot. So, second thing it does, you're probably guessing this already. What's this non-directive counseling on abortion? It eliminates standards in the previous rulemaking set by HHS as to the medical nature of that non-directive counseling. It redefines family planning to focus on abstinence. And this is a real quote, quote, developing a plan for the number and spacing of children. That's what it defines family planning as. And then loosens the quality standards to make it easier for crisis pregnancy centers, which are deceptive Christian ministries that take in young women and scare the hell out of them into not having an abortion, to take part in Title X funds. And then third, it deliberately targets Planned Parenthood. It requires Title X providers that perform abortions do so in, quote, physically separate facilities, end quote, from the facilities where they are providing screening, mammograms, pap smears, and the like. That is just designed to increase the costs on Planned Parenthood. That's all it's meant to do. So congratulations. If you're a woman who supports women's reproductive health and you voted for Donald Trump because you didn't like Hillary's emails, like, this is what you get.
If you're anybody who supports women.
Right. I'm sorry.
Next it'll be like, okay, if you're going to do abortions, you have to be at least 65 feet in the air. You can't, we don't want you on the, like, it's just going to be one thing after the next to try to put anyone who would provide this service out of business.
Well, and that is an excellent transition to our next segment. But I want to end on the gag order by saying, so this is notice of proposed rulemaking. This is exactly like when we covered the initial decision on net neutrality. So this has been promulgated. It will be published in the Federal Register. It will be subject to a 60-day notice and comment period. You are welcome to go out, read it, and file official comments the way we got tens of millions of comments on net neutrality.
And then the government is welcome to say, we didn't count any of those.
Exactly right. There's nothing you're going to be able to do, but you can at least be part of the record. It is going to reach the same end as net neutrality. I mean, it's very clear to me, right? Like, that's why I read the statute. The statute uses broad language, right? It says that the funds are not going to be used for abortions, but the language requires that the agency issue guidance, and it's an executive agency, and executive agencies issue guidance based on who the president is. So, yeah. They're going to enact this. They're going to enact this because Donald Trump cares only about appeasing his evangelical base. And you are not going to be able to stop this in the courts. So there we go.
So in other words, elections.
Yeah, they kind of do, don't they?
I don't want to say it, because everybody will get mad, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they do.
All right. Well, thanks for the breakdown. I think it's important to note that this is not a case of liberal overreaction or misrepresentation. It's pretty much what it seems like, and there's nothing we can do about it. So,
cool. Correct.
Until maybe the midterms won't do it, will it? We'll be we'll be out of luck by then. It's the election, right? It's 2020.
It's the election, right? Yeah. Okay. Trump will still have control of the executive agencies. And I want to flag here, right? Like this ties into, I have been lobbying long and hard about Neil Gorsuch's efforts to undermine Chevron deference, right? This is part of the cost of Chevron deference, right? Like, so let me be clear, right? Like the fact that I want our courts to then defer to this interpretation when you bring the lawsuit, like I get that that's part of the harm. I trust that I've made clear, you know, why I think that system is better than letting conservative judicial activists just do whatever right. the heck they want. But I want to be clear, right? This is why when I make that argument, I am making it from a jurisprudential basis, lefty basis.
Yeah, on paper, yeah. Chevron deference, and indeed, it started off as something that benefited conservatives, right? It's mm-hmm. it's kind of on paper, it should be just basically neutral.
Correct. So and again, right, it should be neutral because this is precisely the thing for which you want to say elections have consequences. And if you don't want to have Health and Human Services that is designed to undermining rather than promoting human health, and you don't want to have an Environmental Protection Agency that is designed to undermine rather than protect the environment, then you know how to vote.
All right. Well, let's transition over to our second topic here. It's an Arkansas law on abortion. What do we got here?
Yeah. And so this is both an Arkansas law and it is recent inaction by the Supreme Court during the middle of last week. So here's the background story. In 2015, so you can't blame this on Trump, but you can blame it on Arkansas being Arkansas. The Arkansas state legislature passed House Bill 1394. I'm going to link that in the show notes. This is exactly to what you were alluding in the prior segment. Okay, it is a bill that is unquestionably, transparently designed to target Planned Parenthood and to make it harder for them to do business and to target women who seek abortions and to make it more difficult for them to exercise their constitutional rights. This is something, again, I recognize we may have pro-life listeners. I have talked about, you know, on our abortion episodes, you know, we're liberal. I'm pretty staunchly pro-choice. But I have talked about the framework set by Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which provides for an overlapping consensus, right? And it recognizes that different people come at abortion in different ways. One of the ways that I think is very non-controversial, except among those who are on the furthest extreme, right, who believe that abortion of a one-day-old fertilized zygote is tantamount to murder. If you're there, I don't really see how we can compromise with that, right? And in the same way that I don't really see how you can compromise with Peter Singer, who thinks that, you know, you ought to be able to, you know, murder children who were 2 or 3 years old, right? Like those are the equivalent positions. 30% of the population agrees with the former and 0% of the population agrees with the latter, rounding down from just Peter Singer and Eli, I think. But those are the polls. Most people are in the middle. HB 1394 concerns the Mifeprex treatment.
How's that?
I wasn't familiar with this. I had to research it. This is the abortion pill, right? Oh. So it is a... Right?
Is this an actual abortion pill, or is this what conservatives say is an abortion pill?
No, it is. It's an actual right, chemical-induced abortion. It must be taken by women who are 7 weeks pregnant or earlier, right? Okay. So it is the early – it is really the earliest stages of what you might consider abortion, right? And so if you are troubled by, you know, things like the – foreshortening window on viability, right? And the fact that we've talked about this in previous episodes, that, you know, the shift from the third trimester approach in Roe to the viability approach in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and the fact that that seems to be dependent on medical technology, which is saving earlier and earlier fetuses who were delivered prematurely. This is not anywhere. 7 weeks.
Yeah, having just gone through all this and been right there along the way as Lydia was was pregnant, you don't even know you're pregnant until like 5 weeks. Like it could be 5 weeks in or something, because you don't know, you know, if you just are late, if you just are whatever. And when you get that first ultrasound of a 5, 6, 7, whatever it is, week old thing, it's literally just like a a bubble. Like there's nothing there. It's just a space where a thing will be eventually. There's almost nothing to it.
Yeah. Seven weeks is at 8 weeks, the track your fetal development sites that are designed to encourage mothers, you know, proudly say your baby is as big as a raspberry, right? Right. 7 weeks is, it is as early in the process. And, you know, again, like I said, if you believe sort of in the spectrum, if you are in the middle on this issue, you ought to be in favor of policies that shift abortions from later in the term to earlier in the term, right? These are the kinds of abortions that we would not want to be undermining, unless your goal is, as it clearly is in Arkansas, to surreptitiously outlaw all abortions mm-hmm. by making them impossible for women to get. So, okay. So we're talking about the Mifeprex regimen. What happens is you take a pill, and then you're supposed to check in with the doctor 3 days later and see if it was effective. And if not, you take an additional dosage and you continue to kind of follow up with your doctor. There is evidence quoted in the statute. I have not been able to verify the veracity of the evidence. Just like a motion to dismiss, I'm going to treat this as true for purposes of the analysis. The fact that this was authored by strident anti-abortion activists, you know, makes me think it might not at all be true, but we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Evidence in the statute that lots of abortion providers are not following the regimen, right, in the same way that lots of people, when you get antibiotics, for example, and it says take them for 21 days, people will take them for 7 days, the infection goes away, and then they stop, right? But that, you know, women are taking the pill, they're no longer pregnant, they don't do the follow-up appointment with the doctor because they're no longer pregnant. And the citation in there is that nationwide there have been complications, including 14 deaths from Mifeprex. So again, let's assume that that is correct, due to eight of those due to infection, right? And so then the bill says, oh, this is a dangerous medical procedure, and we want to protect those women against the dangers of the side effects of Mifeprex. And so it then requires the physician who gives, sells, dispenses, administers, or otherwise provides or prescribes the abortion-inducing drug shall have a signed contract with a physician who agrees to handle complications and be able to produce that signed contract on demand by the patient or the Department of Health. The physician who contracts to handle emergencies shall have active admitting privileges and gynecological surgical privileges at a hospital designed to handle any emergencies associated with the use of or ingestion of the abortion-inducing drug. Every pregnant woman shall receive the name and phone number of the contracted physician and the hospital at which that physician maintains admitting privileges. So enter Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood is the physician who is dispensing Mifeprex. And so this means they have to enter into these contracts with doctors in order to be able to administer the drug. And Planned Parenthood then filed a lawsuit as soon as this law was passed, seeking a preliminary injunction that says, we're unable to get any doctors to sign on to these contracts for a whole lot of reasons, right? And as a result, we think that this law is clearly unconstitutional under Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It is clearly an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion that is constitutionally protected. And we want you to enjoin this law from going into effect. And the district court, the federal district court, said yes, right? And so these are the same injunctive relief standards that you and I have been over multiple times, right?
That
so
I probably of which I can probably remember. 1.5 things. Right.
Well, you've been doing so well on TTTB. I will go through them quickly.
Have I?
They are 1, threat of irreparable harm.
Okay, a threat of irreparable harm. Yeah, sure.
Right.
2, I always remember likelihood of success on the merits.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Balance between the harm and the injury that granting the injunction will impose on the non-moving party. 3, likelihood of success on the merits. And 4, the public interest. Right. So, and you're correct that in most of those cases, right, it's likelihood of success on the merits that is the overwhelming determinant. Here, in addition to likelihood of success on the merits, is also the public interest question, right? Because there is case law, right? It is in Planned Parenthood versus Casey that says the government can assert an interest in protecting potential human life. But yeah, so those are the four parts of the test. This was granted by the district court and then appealed to the Eighth Circuit in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Jegley. And the Eighth Circuit reversed. And what the Eighth Circuit said was that they needed to remand back to the district court for further findings that there actually were going to be undue burdens placed on women under this statute, and that the law required, quote, concrete district court findings estimating the number of women who would either postpone the procedure or pass it up altogether. And then the court said, most women residing in Arkansas and seeking medication abortions, that's the Mifeprex, would be unaffected by the contract physician requirement as they could travel to LRFP, which is Little Rock Family Planning. That is the only other abortion provider in the state of Arkansas. Okay, so you shut down Planned Parenthood, there's one. However, it found, and again, this is the court reversing the preliminary injunction, right? However, the court found that women in the Fayetteville area would have to make two 380-mile round trips to obtain an abortion from LRFP in Little Rock, Arkansas. Nonetheless, the court says, it is unclear how many women would have to travel these additional distances. So Planned Parenthood then petitioned the Supreme Court to intervene in the case prior to it being sent back down, and said, you should take this case on our petition for certiorari, and you should overrule the Eighth Circuit because this is plainly inconsistent with the language of Planned Parenthood versus Casey and subsequent opinions. This is obviously an undue burden, and you do not have to conduct specific fact-finding as to how many women are going to have to drive the 800 miles. And let me say, without going through the brief, I'm going to link the brief in the show notes. I am convinced. Yeah. And yes, you know, disclosing my political biases, et cetera, et cetera. I am 100% convinced by the citations and legal analysis in the brief. So on the merits, I think it's correct. Last week, the Supreme Court declined to grant certiorari in this case. And I want to talk about that at the conclusion of this, because there are a couple of things that are interesting about that, right? So as we know, to grant certiorari only requires 4 votes out of 9. So the liberal wing absolutely could have taken it up, right? They've got 4 votes. The fact that they let this stand, in my view, suggests that they made a strategic calculus, right? And they said, They're one of two things here that trouble me. The first is a view that by the time the court hears the case, that they would be concerned that the court would act in a way that is far, far worse than just letting this stand. That's obviously pretty troubling.
Yeah.
And then the second is related to that, the idea that because of the procedural posture of this case, right? This is a preliminary injunction that you could wind up with losing 5-4, right? This is not a ruling on the merits, right? And you would just say, look, we're gonna let the law go into effect, which it is, and then we could still come back and say the law is unconstitutional. We're just not granting your preliminary injunction right now on the basis of all of the factors. And I think their concern was putting that in the hands of the court's current 5-justice majority, even if you don't think there might be a change in the composition of the court, that putting it in the hands of the current court could result in language that would further undermine the constitutional right to an abortion. That, in my view, that's the only way to read the Supreme Court doing this, right? Like, wow. I want to be clear, this is reading tea leaves about what I think the justices are doing. It has zero precedential effect. We've talked about this before. Letting the Eighth Circuit's decision stand does not imply that the Supreme Court thinks they were correct. Certiorari is discretionary, so you may not, as a lawyer, cite a case and say, "Oh, they petitioned for cert and it was denied, so that means we were right." So the Supreme Court is free to go the other way, but the practical effect is that the PI is dissolved, right? And so this law is going into effect in Arkansas, and it is that brings us all the way back to your teaser from the beginning, right? It is designed to make it impossible for Planned Parenthood to operate, and it is one of two service providers in the entire state.
So is there something about this case that would make it so that they would lift the injunction that isn't related to the merits? So it's one of those other three things, or you think this is just some sort of strategic thing?
Yeah, no, it's the former, right? So by sending it back for fact-finding, you say, I am not convinced that the balance of equities here favors granting injunctive relief, because we're not sure if, you know, how many women are going to have to drive across the state and how many just decide, oh, the hell with it, right? I can't, you know, economically I can't afford to, or it's now too late. I mean, because again, remember, you've got to do that within, you have to sign to get the Mifeprex, you have to begin the regimen at 7 weeks, and then it ends at 9 weeks. After that period, it's not effective. So, you know, to me, it seems, you know, transparently obvious that the facts are going to strongly weigh in favor of the balance of equities. But in the interim, what the court is saying is that from a philosophical perspective, if we don't know how many women it covers, we want to come down on the side of people are allowed through their elective representatives to express that, you know, they want to endorse the government's view of protecting potential life. And so, you know, typically speaking, right, when you pass a law, it goes into effect, even if somebody later challenges it as unconstitutional. So that's the argument on the other side, right? The argument on the other side is, if we're not convinced that the conditions apply, you should let the law go into place. And then if it turns out it's unconstitutional, then, you know, we'll fix it later. Obviously, you know, when you have irreparable harm here, and I don't think anybody could argue, you know, that you don't have irreparable harm, right? You have women who, with this law going into place, are going to be, right, there. It will materially be later in their pregnancy, and they will not be able to go back and get this procedure. So I think it's clear that no side is going to dispute irreparable harm. The question is how the Supreme Court has not stepped in to correct the fact that the Eighth Circuit allowed for this requirement when it runs contrary to what every other court has get to where every other court has come down to date. So I don't want to undermine that it's a bad sign, but I don't want to suggest.
My intuition, my non-expert intuition, is this is a bad sign.
It's a bad sign. Yes, absolutely. It's a bad sign. I do not want to say, and I do not think, I mean, God, this would be the saddest Andrew was wrong ever. Like, I don't think they could possibly win on the merits. But, you know, there's been a lot of stuff I didn't think could go through. It's bad, right? It's really, really bad. So.
All right. Well, elections have got. All right. We're going to move on from that depressing news.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
To, I don't know. Will this be more depressing news? I guess we'll have
no,
to
No, this
find
is
out.
Good news. We're going to end with good
Please.
News. Yes.
Pretty good pleading.
Good news. Okay. Good news, everyone. Let's talk about plea bargaining. More listener comments. Did we end up hearing from like a prosecutor? I want to hear from all sides on this about how Andrew is wrong in different ways.
Me too. So I actually have comments from our public defender friend, from a prosecutor, and from a
Adnan
clerk,
Syed.
Okay. And internationally. So, all right. So this has turned out to be a really contentious subject. It seems to be something that our listeners are interested in. So cool. I'm happy we're going to cover it here. So let's get into it. Last week on episode 176, I quoted, I did not know that I had permission to use this person's name at the time. Now I do. So it is Grant Cole, who is a public defender in Vancouver, Washington.
That's a place I wanted to live. That's super cool. Vancouver, Washington is awesome. It's right past the border, and I don't even want to let the secret out of how good of a place this is to live. No, I will. It's so close to Portland. You can drive, I mean, traffic or whatever, but you can drive right over the bridge to Portland, but you're in Washington, so you got the best of both worlds tax-wise, and it's like a kind of a rural situation oddly close to a city. It's so cool. I really want to live there. Huh. So that's
awesome. I've never been. So,
yeah. So I like that this person's choice of living places. Just want to point that out.
No, that's so in addition to living in a cool place, right? You can look him up. It's grantcolelaw.com. Anyway, so Grant made the comments last week and then wrote back and said, you mentioned how the federal sentencing guidelines have become advisory, but far more people are facing criminal prosecution and incarceration in the state rather than in federal systems. And he provides the evidence. Totally agree with that. We actually talked about that on OA 172, the privatized prison episode. It's a 10-to-1 disparity, right? Only about 10% of defendants are in the federal system. But I kind of think that cuts the other way on his argument, right? Like that you have more mandatory minimums in federal court, right? Most states, unless I'm wrong on this, maybe his experience in Washington is different. At the state level is where the judges tend to have the most amount of discretion. So I think that undercuts the next point that he wants to make, even though I do agree with much of what he says. He says, so first he says, your takeaway seemed to be that because criminal defendants so often plead guilty, the solution would be to revisit how we define a trial in the criminal justice system. I'm going to address that in the next segment. So, but put a pin in that. Then go back to his argument. Grant says, I think the real solution here, rather than limiting someone's ability to contest the charges, we should look at prosecutorial power and how people are sentenced in the United States. I'll give a concrete example as to how this frequently plays out in the state of Washington, in the city where I work. If a person here is charged with selling drugs, a prosecutor has the ability to file an enhancement for selling drugs within a, quote, protected zone. Because Washington has defined protected zones not only within 1,000 feet of a school, but within 1,000 feet of a school bus route, literally the entire city is subject to this particular sentencing enhancement. In turn, if someone is convicted of a charge carrying this enhancement, there's a 2-year period added to that person's sentence, which must be served day for day and is not subject to good time, and the sentencing range is doubled regardless of criminal history. So an innocent defendant facing this type of charge when presented with a reasonable offer from the prosecutor before trial or the objectively unreasonable consequences of losing at trial will have a hard time passing up the chance to plead guilty. Oof. I would argue it is the direct result of the sentencing scheme that there are not a lot of trials in this jurisdiction for selling drugs.
And this is a blue state.
Yeah. I mean, remember that, right? Again, this is Overton window, right? The Republicans, beginning with Richard Nixon, have painted, you know, tough on crime equals Republicans, liberal on crime, pro defendants' rights equals Democrats. It is much more tough on crime equals all Republicans and most Democrats. Pro defendants' rights equals a couple of oddball libertarians, and you know, good on them for that. Yeah. And a tiny segment of very, very liberal Democrats.
We gotta move that window back over.
Yep, I agree. So I agree 100% with that analysis, and I wanted to read the examples because I think it puts some meat on the bone of prosecutorial discretion. I don't know that it contradicts what I was saying, but I like it as part of the picture. The one aside about the revisiting how we define a trial in the criminal justice system, I think, ties in nicely to the second comment I received. And again, we received a bunch of these, but I picked some representative examples. So this came from friend of the show, Adrian Thurin, who says, you implied initially that countries without plea bargains tend to be on the more authoritarian side. For your information, there is no such thing as a plea bargain in France, which I think you will agree is a decent democracy. So let me jump in there. I tried to listen to hear if I used authoritarian. I don't think I used the word authoritarian. I might have said inquisitorial. What I meant was non-adversarial, right? So in many European nations, the trial is not like a trial here where, you know, you pick teams. You actually have this inquisitorial system where, you know, the judge conducts the trial, the judge will appoint court-appointed experts, rather than each side gets to bring in their own experts, and you kind of go at it. And my comment was not even to prefer one to the other. Although, you know, again, it's kind of hard with my bias not to prefer the adversarial system. Mm-hmm. It's been my entire adult life, but rather to say that when we look at international comparisons on whether other countries have plea bargains or not, there are just so many points of disanalogy. And that, and taking that a bit further, some of the pro plea bargaining folks have, so some of the anti plea bargaining folks have said, look, you know, there are countries like France in which there's no plea bargaining. And then the pro plea bargaining folks will rightly say two things. They'll say, number one, I don't know how comparable France is to the United States. And number two, one of the big points of disanalogy is that we believe in sort of the full adversarial right to a trial. And that's what lengthens trial times and causes the court clog and everything else. Adrian continues, a limited version was introduced 10 years ago, but it is restricted to misdemeanors and only in cases where the person was caught during the act. So it is possible to make a justice system not completely crippled without plea bargains, although admittedly, the French system is slow due to massive underfunding. It's typically about a year to get to trial for misdemeanors or work-related conflicts in the Paris area, but pretrial jail is far from systematic and must be justified on a case-by-case basis. The default is no jail before conviction. So, you know, again, I just think that highlights the difficulty in importing that to the United States. Here, pretrial detention is, I don't want to say automatic, but is virtually automatic with many defendants, and we imprison so many people that you know, if you have that kind of delay for misdemeanors in Paris, that strikes me as supporting the court clog argument that I was making.
Yeah, because there's no way you're even touching our American prison industrial complex going on here. So
that's international. Then we heard from an anonymous former prosecutor, and he says, I was a prosecutor in New York. I agree that most of the misdemeanor trials I conducted, around 80, were one-day affairs. In fact, they were mostly bench trials, not jury trials. A bench trial could take an hour or two. Even the jury trials took one day, sometimes two. With respect to felony trials, they ran the gamut. Sometimes they were almost the same as a misdemeanor trial. For example, felony driving while intoxicated, where the only added element is a previous conviction, which the defendant usually admits to outside of the presence of the jury. Others, like murders or complicated economics crimes cases, could last a week or two. Plea bargaining still helped clear the court congestion, though. While on intake in city court, we could be assigned anywhere from 30 to 80 violation level and misdemeanor level cases per day. Intake usually lasted a month, and we had 8 months to dispose of these cases before we could go on intake again. The vast majority of these cases would be disposed of with plea bargains or dismissals with conditions attached, like community service, restitution, or orders of protection. If each of these cases had gone to trial, the system would be overwhelmed. Personally, other factors went into my desire to plea bargain most cases. For one thing, I wanted the certainty of those conditions I listed above. Restitution was much more important to me than the stigma of criminal conviction in lots of cases. And second, believe it or not, they still teach rendering the deeds of mercy in law school. So I appreciated that insight there. And, you know, you see, I think that does support the notion that you know, there is a significant amount of prosecutorial discretion. But I want to definitely give voice to the idea that, you know, not all prosecutors are, you know, using this to build their careers. Hashtag not all prosecutors. There we go. No, I that was a great comment. That leads to the comment from an anonymous judicial clerk. So,
jeez.
Trying to weigh in from the
can we get an anonymous Supreme Court justice to comment in, please?
Yes,
and I'll settle for a circuit court.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, and this person says, I have served as a clerk to a federal district judge for nearly a year now. Those federal district clerkships, those are big deals, right? So this is this is somebody coming out of the upper echelons of an Ivy League law school, I imagine. From inside a judge's chambers, it feels a little weird to hear a PD say that most trials could be done between 1 and 3 days. Factually, this is 100% true. I have sat through more than a dozen criminal trials so far, and the majority of them were 3 days or fewer. However, I think that this underestimates the strain that trials place on a judge's time. First, I should say that I wholeheartedly believe in a defendant's right to a fair and speedy trial, and I have serious personal concerns about the state of prosecution vis-a-vis charging discretion, mandatory minimums, and the appellate waivers that government makes defendants sign. That said, the difference between a 20 to 30 minute arraignment colloquy and a 3 day trial is immense from behind the bench. For example, the judges of the court where I am clerking have a docket that is close to 750 cases.
Wow.
The time it takes to prepare and preside over even a one-day trial is much greater than what it takes in cases where the defendant pleads out. Today, the judge arraigned 10 defendants in little more time than it takes to select a jury and hear opening statements. I don't have any magic solutions, but I thought that adding another layer of context could be helpful. And I totally agree with that. So this is something that I want us to continue to have as part of the discussion. And I think it shows that, it's a complex issue and there are no easy answers. We got some guidance from a really, really interesting decision from the Iowa Supreme Court.
Mm.
And this is a case called Schmidt versus Iowa. It is an Iowa State Supreme Court decision, so I am not going to delve into the legal reasons, therefore, because it has to do with interpreting the Iowa Constitution and, therefore is not of use to anybody who doesn't practice in Iowa. But what the Iowa Supreme Court held was that you, as a criminal defendant, have an absolute right to petition for writ of habeas corpus on the grounds that you are actually innocent, even if you engage in a plea bargain, even if you have pled guilty. In order to do so, this is the first decision that I have seen that goes this far. In order to do that, so let me say that has tremendous implications for things like the Innocence Project and for DNA evidence that conclusively exonerates individuals who have been convicted. And it is the first time I've seen a court, in some of the language that I'm going to quote, mention some of the things that our listeners have mentioned, right? Which is the fundamental issue with which the court is concerned is, do innocent people plead guilty in order to avoid the structural harms of the system? So first, let me set the background. This only applies in Iowa, will not help you if you are not in Iowa, for two reasons. Number one, on the federal level, you do not have a federal habeas right to petition the government to let you out on the grounds that you are actually innocent. We've talked about this before. This case is a 1993 case called Herrera versus Collins.
I wish we had time to go back through that because how is that possible? But okay.
Yeah, here's this. That was a case in which someone else, there was a person in jail, someone else confessed to the crime and was arrested and sentenced. And then the guy said, look, like you put that dude in jail, you should let me out. And then
Scalia said,
well, this is actually a Rehnquist decision, Scalia voted with the majority.
Right.
Claims of actual innocence based on newly discovered evidence have never been held to state a ground for federal habeas relief, absent an independent constitutional violation occurring in the underlying state criminal proceeding. So doesn't matter that you're innocent. That doesn't get you habeas.
I don't understand.
Terrible. Yeah.
You could explain that to me 100 times. I won't understand how that.
I'm with you. So that led states to enact various statutes.
I love what's the slippery slope of that? Well, if we let innocent people leave prison, then then what's next? Innocent people, we won't be able to kill them? What is the slippery slope, or what is the danger? What is the possible downside?
I'll tell you what I think it is. And this is, we called this out on one of our Laudawful movies, maybe Body of Evidence. During the 1990s, during the 1980s and the 1990s, the right wing maintained an attack on the criminal justice system such that the prevailing view was, we sentence people, but then, they just get to file frivolous appeals forever. Yeah. And I think that's that's the only thing that explains this is, we got to cut down on habeas relief because
it's definitely the right wing Supreme Court justices were watching too many movies. I guess that's how they're making their decisions.
I think it was part of, I think the movies were symptomatic and again, who knows, Rehnquist could have been watching Body of Evidence, you never know. But
who was the guy who did the, I don't know what porn, I'll know porn when I see it or whatever.
Louis Brandeis. But
yeah, cause that would be what you'd say when you're watching Body of Evidence, but okay.
Right. I think the movie was indicative of the cultural zeitgeist where even, the average person on the left would be like, I agree. I mean, we have far too many frivolous appeals. Mm-hmm. And If we could not go true. Back in time, that would be a great argument to pick up, but it really wasn't being made by anybody. So that would be my supposition. Sorry to take you on a rabbit trail.
We're running out of time.
It's a good trail. So states passed laws that provided for a protection. So, for example, in Maryland, we have a statute that says an individual who has a, quote, substantial or significant possibility that the result at trial may have been different can file a state habeas petition asserting actual innocence. But our state courts have determined that that statute does not apply if you have plea bargained, right? If you have confessed guilt, then you don't get to take advantage of that. So this is a debate going forward, and the Iowa court is the first court that I have seen that goes the other way, that says we are going to allow you to maintain a claim for actual innocence even if you pled guilty. And I'm not going to read from the opinion because we're running short on time. It begins on page 13. The court first cites data from the National Exoneration Project, shows that 74 individuals who have pled guilty have been subsequently exonerated in recent years, and then gives five reasons why this happens. Uncertainty about trial, coerced confessions by police officers change the calculus, right? So in other words, the police illegally coerce you into confessing. And then even though, you know, you might be able to go to trial and probably get it suppressed, that alters the negotiations, right? They then come in and go, yeah, we beat this confession out of you. We know you're guilty. Why don't you take the deal? Number three, the economic cost-benefit analyses, right? Like if you face long mandatory minimum sentences, you know, that we've talked about, you might decide to plead guilty even though it's still going to be time in order to avoid those terrible outcomes or avoid the death penalty. And number four, prosecutorial discretion. And number five, defense imbalance. And that is the generally overworked dockets of state-appointed public defenders. So it's a super interesting case. I got to tell you, the facts on this are bad, right? This is not this is not a DNA case. This is a case where the victim subsequently recanted their testimony. But the Iowa Supreme Court said that they will allow, the standard will be a standard of clear and convincing evidence, which is more than 50-50, but less than beyond a reasonable doubt. And that if you can show that, that's grounds to reverse a conviction on habeas corpus grounds and entitle you to a new trial. So part of the solution, right, is recognizing that just because somebody has pled guilty doesn't mean that they were guilty.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much for all the letters and emails and faxes. I don't know why I said letters, but and then faxes and other sources of information. No, thanks for the participation. Seriously, if you're somebody who has insight into anything we talk about, it's really awesome to hear from you. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I loved getting this.
You're going to love this. Believe me, this is the greatest part of the program.
It's cool. Just cool. Nice.
Thank you.
Well, it is time to thank our new patrons over at patreon.com/law, where, of course, you can enjoy the latest and all of the Lot Awful movies. Right now, it's Lot Awful Movies 19, 12 Angry Men. Great movie. It was a fun time had by all. But we've got to thank our new patrons, Zig Smash, that you are here. Sci-fi audio drama. I tricked Brian into repledging for some reason. I forget why, but he did. But woo! Thanks, Brian. Alex Eveleth, Finn Hersfield, Pro Hawk Beach Day. Pro Hawk Beach Day. I love that. Mike and Ryan from the Unholy Generation podcast. Cult of One. Amy Marie Mason, 4 of 20, tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 69. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Al Goines and Joshua Bowers.
Yeah, and thank you to Aaron Golliver, to Tino Muvanga Musingarimi, and my apologies if I have botched that. Thank you to Elizabeth Warren is trying to starve my friends via EBHTA. To Tony, Pro Hawk Vice Skater.
A lot of good Pro Hawk Vice jokes in this one.
To Tone Glavinix. To Benjamin Crom. To Sorosh Mohadasi. Boy, I got the slightly more challenging names this week. Usually they go to Thomas. And again, my apologies if I screwed that one up. To Mark Malloy, Jeremy Brown, and R. Hudson, thank you all so much for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. It's what helps make the show go. And if you want to join their ranks, head on over to patreon.com/law. Sign up for as little as $1 an episode. We'll read out your name. We'll read out anything you want. And you can go to bed happy knowing that you help keep the show on the air.
All right, let's find out what on earth happened with that bar question. Oh, man.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, so this is an evidence question. This involves a witness who attested that they agreed with a certain manual, and then the opposing side decided that they were going to cross X him on it. And he said, well, you know, is the manual perfect? And no, nobody's perfect. And then the defendant called their own expert who said that that Smith book is just terrible. It was once reliable, now badly out of date. Does the jury get to examine the treatise? And I love the way you approached answering this question. I always like it when you go out on a limb and eliminate both of the yes answers. You were like, no, that doesn't make any sense.
You know, I might be wrong, but if I'm wrong, I don't want to be right. No, I don't know. Whatever. Because, like, it doesn't make any sense that you're going to tell me that 13th century Saxony law allows that the jury reads through something, the parchment, and decides, and it's like, it's stupid. So I eliminated C&D.
Yeah. Yeah, milling law, which may date back to 13th century Saxony. Yeah. When you're walking counterclockwise around a mill. No, you eliminated C and D, the two yes answers. Good eliminations.
All right.
That absolutely, it just goes to show that, no, you the fact that two experts went back and forth over a particular treatise doesn't mean that the audience gets to call for the treatise and just like read up on law in the middle of the jury room.
Everybody just sits there like, you done yet? Or
this concerns Federal Rule of Evidence 803 subsection 18, which is a one of the extensive hearsay exceptions. Because remember, a treatise is hearsay. It is an out of court statement made by somebody other than declarant that is entered into evidence for the purpose of to prove the truth of the contents. So treatises are hearsay. They may be admissible hearsay when you read statements from the treatise where the treatise is, quote, called to the attention of an expert witness or relied upon by the expert and found reliable by the court. So your general impression was correct. If either of the witnesses had read out any statements from the treatise, then that would have been admissible, but they didn't. So it isn't. So the only question is why. Is it better to say no? The jury may only consider passages read to it by counsel or witness, or because the expert has to rely on the treatise in his testimony. And sadly, the answer is A. The answer is yes. But again, you know, I really want to point out the excellent job you did analyzing the question. Wrong result, but really good job breaking it down and showing how we can understand these kinds of questions just from common sense.
I guess. I don't really understand this one, to be honest with you. But Thomas' second chance presidency 2020, vote me in. Within two tries, I will have solved whatever I need to solve. That's, you know, as long as being president involves a lot of multiple choice questions, which, you know, in a way it does, I'd be a good president. But
I wish the presidency were multiple choice at this point. At least we could constrain Trump a little bit.
I could form a good cabinet that would just please present everything to me in a multiple choice series question where there's four answers and I will eliminate two of them for you. And then we'll see what happens from there. It'd be better than what we have going now is all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
So I guess it just to clarify, they didn't rely on the is B. Why is B wrong exactly? It's just not quite the best answer. I don't get it.
Because what you can do, it's a really, look, this is a super hard question. You you don't just, you, so you analyzed it correctly. Treatise's hearsay, it only comes in if sections out of it are read by the witness. So one of the things you can do with an expert witness is you can put the treatise in front of them and say, are you familiar with Smith on Milling Law? Yes. Is Smith on Milling Law generally reliable? Yes. Okay, I want you to read page 234 that I've marked, that I've highlighted here, and then they read it and it contradicts their opinion. And you say, okay, so, you know, Mr. Smith, you just saw that Smith on Milling Law contradicts your opinion. Your opinion isn't consistent with that, is it? And then they will say, well, yes or no, because of X, Y, Z. So in other words, the rule provides that the treatise can be either called to the attention of an expert witness or relied upon by the expert, and B said it's only admissible if it was relied on by the expert. Super technical, hairline distinction, but that's why A is better than B.
I don't get it, but I'll take your word for it. Either way, I'm wrong. And let's go to your time machine, hop in that limited use time machine, and tell us who got the question right. Who's our winner of this week's TTTBE?
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice...
All right, Thomas, this week's winner is Woogie Whips on Twitter, who says, quote, Your Honor, I would like to enter into evidence an entire four-year course in electrical engineering, said no lawyer ever. The answer is A, because requiring a jury to read an entire book is similarly burdensome to the jury and pointless without the expertise to evaluate it. So Woogie Whips was first past the post with the right answer. Really good answer. Pretty funny. Everyone should give him a follow on Twitter. That is at @WOOGY_WIPS. Not sure if Woogie Whips is an electric slide reference, but in any event, he is this week's TTTBE winner. Congratulations.
All right, well, that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks so much for TTTBEing and patronizing and writing in and all the things you do. It's really fun. Check out that Opening Arguments online Facebook community there. That's another fun place to be. We're loving it. Thanks so much, and we'll see you for another Rapid Response Friday in a few days here.
See ya.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.